From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. We may not be certain what chemical and biological weapons Iraq has in its arsenal, or whether Iraq has made or will make these weapons available to terrorist groups, but we do know something about the chemical attacks Saddam Hussein already launched against the Kurds in Iraq. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Jeffrey Goldberg, a staff writer for The New Yorker, who has reported on Saddam's chemical attack on Halabja in 1988. Also, we'll talk with satirist Harry Shearer. He's just written and directed a new movie called Teddy Bear's Picnic. It's a satire based on the Bohemian Grove, a secretive retreat for rich and powerful men. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Arab leaders wrapped up their first day of talks at a two-day Arab summit in Beirut. The leaders were expected to focus on a Saudi peace proposal, but instead the gathering was marked by squabbles. NPR's Kate Seeley reports from Beirut.
Hopes for a unified Arab gathering were dashed when a dispute led to a walkout by the Palestinian delegation. They were angered by a Lebanese decision not to air a live satellite address by their absent leader, Yasser Arafat. He chose not to attend the summit because of Israeli-imposed travel conditions. Lebanon later cited a misunderstanding over the speech, and the Palestinians agreed to attend Thursday's session. But the quarrel underscored long-standing Arab tensions and overshadowed a highly anticipated Saudi peace plan. Crown Prince Abdullah called upon Arab delegates to endorse an initiative offering Israel normal relations and security in exchange for its withdrawal from all occupied Arab lands, including East Jerusalem. Kate Seeley, NPR News, Beirut.
The Palestinian group Hamas has claimed responsibility for a suicide bombing that left 19 people dead and more than 120 wounded today at a seaside resort north of Tel Aviv. The bombing took place in a hotel dining room as guests gathered for the traditional meal at the beginning of Passover. The Palestinian Authority issued a statement strongly condemning the bombing. Arthur Andersen continues to lose customers because of its role in the Enron scandal. Today, New Jersey officials ordered Atlantic City casinos to sever their ties to the firm. NPR's Jim Zaroli reports.
The New Jersey Casino Control Commission voted 5-0 to bar casinos from doing business with Andersen after May 15th. The move had been requested by Attorney General David Sampson, who said Andersen's recent indictment for shredding Enron-related documents made it impossible to trust its casino audits. But the commission stopped short of applying the ban to casino subsidiaries and affiliates, as Sampson had requested. The commission's decision is being closely watched in other states. Some Nevada casinos have already discussed severing their ties to Andersen, although state gambling officials have so far made no move to ban the firm. Andersen has argued that the firm shouldn't be punished because of the actions of a few rogue employees. Jim Zaroli, NPR News.
Andersen said today that it has not made any final decisions on reductions in its U.S. workforce. The accounting firm issued a statement saying that some layoffs will be inevitable. The statement followed a story posted on the website of the Financial Times saying that Andersen plans to lay off more than 20% of its U.S. workforce, or nearly 6,000 people. In stocks today, the Dow gained 73 points to close at 10,426 in active trading. The Nasdaq gained 2 points. This is NPR News. Comedian and television pioneer Milton Berle has died. He was 93. Berle's career spanned the era from vaudeville to video, where he was known as Mr. Television. His Tuesday night comedy program was credited with boosting the sale of television sets and bringing the medium to ordinary American households. British actor, comedian, and musician Dudley Moore has died at his home in New Jersey after battling a rare brain disorder similar to Parkinson's disease. NPR's Andy Bowers reports.
After a troubled childhood in East London, Dudley Moore shot to prominence right out of Oxford University in 1960 when he became one of the stars of the comedy revue Beyond the Fringe. The show was a hit in both London and New York and launched Moore's longtime collaboration with fellow comedian Peter Cook. The two starred in the original 1967 film version of Bedazzled. Moore then moved to Hollywood, where he starred in more movies, including the comedy Ten with Bo Derek in 1979. 2 years later, Moore starred as an alcoholic millionaire in the hit comedy Arthur. Moore was also a noted pianist and composer. He was married and divorced 4 times and had children from 2 of those marriages. Dudley Moore was 66. Andy Bowers, NPR News, Los Angeles.
President Bush signed the finance reform bill into law today, and one of the strongest congressional opponents immediately filed suit to prevent the law from taking effect. Kentucky Republican Senator Mitch McConnell took the issue to court, saying the law violates constitutional guarantees of free speech. The National Rifle Association filed a separate suit against the law. President Bush said he signed the measure, although he objects to its limits on outside advertising. The new law doesn't take effect until November. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, maker of natural vitamin E, ADM, the nature of what's to come, on the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. It's unclear what chemical and biological weapons Iraq has today and what weapons Iraq has made or might make available to terrorist groups. But we do know that Saddam Hussein has already launched chemical attacks in Iraq, although most of us know very little about what happened. In the early 90s, Human Rights Watch published a report titled Iraq's Crime of Genocide, which estimated that between 50 and 100,000 people were killed in chemical attacks launched by Saddam's regime against as many as 200 Iraqi villages and towns. My guest journalist Jeffrey Goldberg has written about the chemical attack on the city of Halabja in northern Iraq on March 16, 1988. Halabja was then home to about 80,000 Kurds, many of whom opposed Saddam's regime. Goldberg traveled to Halabja, interviewed survivors and doctors, and published his report in last week's New Yorker. He's a staff writer for the magazine and covers the Middle East. One of the survivors he spoke with, named Nasreen, was in her basement at the time of the attack, taking shelter from bombs. I asked Goldberg what Nasreen saw when she emerged.
She was the first one in her family, as best as I can tell, to notice that something was awry. There was something different about March 16th. She had been in the kitchen cooking with her sister for the 30 or 40 relatives who were in her basement, and she saw a helicopter come by with photographers in it, taking pictures of Halabja, an army helicopter, and she thought that was very strange. She went into the basement when the artillery bombardment occurred. You have to understand something here that's so diabolically clever. The Iraqis, knowing that gas is heavier than air and would penetrate cellars and basements more effectively, drove everybody into the basements by launching a conventional artillery attack on the town for several hours. In other words, they knew that people would do what they always did during an artillery barrage and run to their basements. They were stuck in their basements, and then they launched the chemical weapons attack, which this, of course, made the chemical weapons attack very effective because the gas started seeping into the basements and the cellars, turning them really, I mean, the way it was described to me really is as gas chambers, in essence. Nasreen came out. She saw that her family partridge, a bird in a cage, was dying. She saw some of the farm animals dying, and she went downstairs to her family, and a lot of the people in the basement were getting sick rather quickly. The children were vomiting. The old people were vomiting. Their eyes were becoming extremely red, and they had to make this awful decision: stay in the basement, which was what they had been conditioned to do during an attack, or go out on the street and run and risk being exposed. Eventually, they decided to get out. They started making their way out of town. A lot of the small children, Nasreen was only 16 at the time, but she was married already, but a lot of the small children, cousins and nephews and extended family, couldn't walk any longer, so they had to be carried. And what happened in this exodus from the town, they were trying to get to the hills, obviously. What happened in this exodus was that people just would fall along the roads, along the roadsides. They would just fall and collapse. The mustard gas in particular was burning out their lungs and creating conditions in which they couldn't breathe.
So after Nasreen and her families decided to run for the hills, they managed to jump on a truck.
Right.
A truck that was carrying the dying and the dead.
Right.
And
right.
How far did they get on the truck?
Well, they didn't get very far because the driver was blinded. People in this town lost their vision in a matter of minutes and sometimes, certainly over several hours. He was blinded. His own family was in this truck. And he basically said he got out of the truck blind and sort of yelled at everybody, you know, get out if you can, but I can't go on. And he wandered away. And Nasreen, it's interesting, 14 years after the fact, still sort of apologizes for his behavior. And it's her belief that possibly some of the nerve agents that were used affected his mental capacity, affected his ability to think clearly. And that's the way she explains his decision, if you will, to abandon his family. The people who still could see led the people who couldn't up a little bit into the hills, where they found a mosque that was empty, and then they found a house next to a mosque. They went to the house, and people started dying there. They were looking for food. Of course, the food was probably contaminated by that point. The children were screaming, that their eyes were bleeding, that they couldn't see, that they were all blinded. And then at a certain point in that long, dark night, Nasreen herself went blind. And it was only because her husband, a man named Bakhtiar, who was outside the village, outside the town at the time, managed to find her, that I think they survived. He had his vision, and he wasn't directly affected by the chemicals. And so he organized them and washed them up and tried to give medicine to those he could. And I think that's why they survived.
Her husband had managed to get two syringes of a medication, atropine, that's supposed to counter the effects of chemical attacks. How did he get them, and who did he decide to use those two syringes on?
This was not the first chemical attacks in Kurdistan, so people knew a little bit about what to do. He was a physician's assistant, so he had some training in this. And the Kurdish guerrillas who were fighting the Iraqi regime had managed to gather up some syringes of atropine. He had a couple that he got from a clinic, and he injected himself. This is before he found Nasreen. He injected himself, a wise decision, obviously. It meant that he could function and help people. He had one more, and he was faced with this, I don't want to invoke this too lightly, but kind of a Sophie's choice, if you will. When he found the 20 or 30 people who were with Nasreen in the house up on the hill, many throwing up, many blinded, many obviously suffering, he had a choice. He could have injected Nasreen, but he didn't. He found the person who seemed to be suffering the most, a woman named Azmi, who, as they described it, was experiencing kind of a psychological breakdown or mental breakdown caused either by reality, the events that she was seeing, or by the actual workings of nerve agents on her brain. She was slamming herself into walls and doing all kinds of very destructive things. So he chose to use this one syringe of atropine on her, but she died anyway. And I think to this day he still questions his decision not to inject his own wife with this one syringe of atropine that he had. And it's fascinating to watch the dynamic between the two of them, because she has forgiven him completely for his decision to help the most seriously injured person.
What were the long-term effects of the chemical attack on Nasreen?
She was blind for 20 days. They were eventually taken to Iran, to hospitals in Iran. She was blind for 20 days. She had some burning, some mustard gas-related burning on her skin. But the most insidious, terrible effect on Nasreen was the following. She was in the hospital. And let me preface this by saying that Kurdish society is quite conservative. It's a Muslim society. And she said that she noticed and told her doctors very quietly that she began to menstruate soon after she got to the hospital in Iran. And it didn't stop after a few days. It just kept going. She was horrified by this. She found out through quiet conversation with some of the other women that they too were menstruating and couldn't stop. Eventually, they told the doctors, and the doctors prescribed the medicine to help stop this bleeding. But the doctors told her at the same time that she would be infertile, that she could not bear children. She didn't believe them. She chose not to believe them. And 2 years later, back in Kurdistan already, this is after the Gulf War, she conceived, and she delivered a baby boy. And Bakhtiar and Nasreen named the baby boy the Kurdish word for hope. What happened was that the baby had a hole in his heart, and he died after 3 months. And that was the last time she became pregnant. And that's her story. And this is a story that's replicated across Kurdistan. Various problems with congenital malformations of babies conceived after the attacks. Obviously, and if you broaden it out, the problems range from colon cancer, skin cancers, lung cancer, liver cancer, to cleft palates and hair lips and strange tumors growing on people's backs. Obviously, the long-term effects on the lungs of mustard gas are lung scarring and diminished capacity to breathe. A lot of these people need lung transplants, which, of course, they can't get in Kurdistan. The effects are never-ending. I could go on all day about them, but I think that gives you a snapshot of what's happening there.
My guest is journalist Jeffrey Goldberg. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is journalist Jeffrey Goldberg, and in a recent edition of The New Yorker, he reported on the short and long-term effects of the Saddam Hussein administration's chemical attacks on Kurdistan in 1988. Part of your article is devoted to the story of Nasreen and what she saw and experienced on the day of the attacks. How did you meet Nasreen?
When I got to Kurdistan, the Kurds who were running their own self-government, their own administration, if you will, in the north of Iraq, are obviously quite keen to get their story out to the world. They don't get a lot of journalists visiting them. So when I told various Kurdish officials what I was interested in doing, namely meeting victims of the chemical weapons attacks, they organized for me very efficiently different groups in different cities of people who had been attacked in this town or that town. These meetings are very difficult. Obviously, it's very difficult for a journalist to focus, if you will, on seven different stories coming at him at once. It's also very difficult to keep your own humanity and express the sympathy that you feel when there's so many people and you're so inundated with these terrible stories. Something about Nasreen stood out, though. It was the sort of the biblical-sized calamity that occurred to her family. She lost five siblings in this attack, as well as her mother, and her father was permanently blinded. She was also a very composed, very eloquent woman, and obviously very frank, telling me about her problems with menstruation. I mean, here I am, an American male journalist she had never met before, and she was willing to talk about these things.
Now, you interviewed several other people who survived the chemical attack in Halabja.
Yes. Yeah.
Were their stories similar to Nasreen's?
Yes, what's interesting is that families, extended families, huddled together during these attacks. So those families who were in cellars which were affected, those families were wiped out. It's really astonishing, actually, to meet some people in Halabja who did not have a single person in their family die, and then to meet others who tell you very matter-of-factly, and also hand you lists, of 120 relatives they lost, or 80 relatives that they lost in one day. It all had to do with where the chemicals were dropped, and so you do hear stories also, by the way, of families that were completely wiped out. I visited a woman in a house that was attacked. She's a new owner of the house, and she said, as far as she knows, every single member of the extended family that was in this house during the attack died.
Now, you've mentioned that there were many long-term health effects of the chemical attacks,
right?
Cancers of all sorts, and other lung problems. One of the odd long-term effects that you mentioned is that snakes became more toxic.
Well, this is a very interesting point. I heard this from many Kurdish doctors, and they said this in terms of, be careful, because the snakes in Halabja are very numerous and aggressive. I didn't see any snakes, but I started asking around about this, and they said, well, yes, what happened was, and they said, we don't know what happened. We don't know more than we know about a whole range of issues. This is one of them. We think that in the chemical attacks, a particular kind of bird that eats snakes was wiped out. The snakes were not affected. Therefore, they reproduced at a much greater pace and therefore became much more numerous. There are also physicians who say they believe that the bites, that the venom of these snakes is more toxic now due to a mutation caused by the chemical weapons. I talked to a number of Western experts on this, and they said this could have a couple of explanations. One is that this could be sort of a mass psychosis, if you will, that the people having been afflicted with this biblically sized plague believe all kinds of terrible things about their environment that aren't true. Another possible explanation is that it is true that the environmental imbalances caused by the wiping out of various bird species in that immediate area did lead to a great number of snakes being born and not being eaten by birds. They said that it's probably not true that the snakes had actually mutated into something more deadly. But this brings me to a point that's incredibly important to make, which is that this chemical weapons attack on Halabja and the chemical weapons attacks on nearly 200 other villages and towns have never been studied by Western scientists. We don't know what happened in Halabja to any point of precision. We don't even know for sure what chemical agents were used. We have our suspicions. American scientists have their suspicions.
We'll get to that in a second. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, this issue of the snakes is one manifestation of this lack of knowledge about what really happened there.
How long did it take until the site of the attacks was no longer toxic?
It might still be toxic. We don't know that it's not toxic. Nothing's been decontaminated. I mean, I had this moment when I was standing in one of these basements where, I was told 100 people had died. And I turned to one of the doctors who was accompanying me, and I said, is this place been decontaminated? It just struck me all of a sudden. And he said, nothing in Kurdistan has ever been decontaminated. It's amazing to think about the decontamination process that's going on in the Brentwood Postal Facility in Washington, D.C., or one of the Senate office buildings after the anthrax attacks. Nothing like that has ever taken place. Scientists believe that the half-lives of nerve agents are very short. Mustard gas can linger in the environment. Again, the problem is we do not understand fully the range of weapons used on the Kurds and on the water and food supply of Kurdistan. So as far as these people are concerned, they're living in contaminated areas. It's kind of like going back to Chernobyl and living there.
What do experts now think was in the brew that Saddam Hussein used in the chemical attack on Halabja?
They believe with a reasonable degree of certainty that it was mustard gas in combination with three nerve agents, VX, sarin, and tabun. There are suspicions, and these are suspicions that are held by Kurdish doctors as well as some people in the West, that Saddam mixed in this brew a biological agent called aflatoxin. There's no proof that it was used, but there's, of course, no proof that it wasn't because no one has ever studied this. Aflatoxin is a mycotoxin. It's a mold that grows on grain, and it's in weaponized form, it can only do one thing, which is cause long-term liver cancer, particularly in children. The Kurdish doctors see elevated rates of liver cancer in children, and they've sort of walked this backwards, if you will, and are questioning whether aflatoxin was also used. But we don't know. We simply don't know.
Now, you've been wondering if al-Qaeda or other Islamic extremist groups might get toxic weapons from Iraq. Are there any connections you've been able to find between Saddam Hussein and al-Qaeda?
When I was in Kurdistan, I started to do some research about a terrorist group operating in one corner of the area. It's called the Ansar al-Islam, which means supporters of Islam. It was formerly known as the Jund al-Islam, the Soldiers of Islam. This group is al-Qaeda influenced, if you will. Its ideology is very similar. And many of its leaders, according to the people I spoke to, are quote-unquote Afghan Arabs, people who cycled through Afghanistan either to fight the Soviets or to train in the camps of al-Qaeda. So there is very little doubt that this group is linked to al-Qaeda in some serious way. What I found, or what I heard, I should say, were allegations from credible people who said that, in fact, this group is co-sponsored. It's not under the sole sponsorship of Al-Qaeda. It's co-sponsored, the other sponsor being Saddam's intelligence service. This makes sense. This has the benefit of making sense. Saddam and Al-Qaeda have an interest in destabilizing the Kurdish free zone, if you will, the area of Iraq that's under the protection of the American Air Force in the no-fly zone. So it would make sense that they would work together on this project. And of course, Saddam's intelligence agents and Al-Qaeda operatives do share a hatred of America and a hatred of America's allies, who include most definitively the Kurds, the Kurdish leadership in Kurdistan. So I guess I'm left with this feeling. When I was there, I asked my Kurdish sources on this subject, why they were giving me so much information on this. And they said, well, we really want you to go back to Washington and tell the CIA that we have all this information about Al-Qaeda and its links to Saddam, because we think that this is useful information. Which of course raised the question, you mean the CIA hasn't been here? And they said no, and we're trying to get them interested. The only conclusion I would draw definitively from these encounters is that this is an area worthy of further American exploration. This would be an interesting place for American intelligence agents, officers, to go and explore. And that's what I came away with.
Of course, the people you were speaking to wouldn't necessarily know if the CIA had been there.
No, the people I was speaking to would know. I'm talking about the head of the Kurdish intelligence agency.
Oh, yes, okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah. I mean, he could be not telling me the truth. I was just, after several days with these people, I felt that they were more earnest than manipulative.
Mm-hmm.
And that their desire was really, you know, could you please let them know what's going on over here and have them come out? And you know, I was open to the idea that I was being used by the Kurds, but after several days of exploring this, I decided, no, you know, there really might be something here, and it really might be something useful for American intelligence service to actually go and explore.
Jeffrey Goldberg is a staff writer for The New Yorker. He covers the Middle East. His article, The Great Terror, was published in the March 25th edition of the magazine. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. And from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. And by Avalon Travel Publishing, publisher of Moon Handbook's travel guides to Asia, the Pacific, and the Americas, on the web at moon.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, more on Saddam Hussein's 1988 chemical attack on the Kurds in Halabja. Also, satirist Harry Shearer talks about the new movie he wrote and directed, Teddy Bear's Picnic. It's a satire based on the Bohemian Grove, a secretive retreat for rich and powerful men.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Jeffrey Goldberg, a staff writer for The New Yorker who covers the Middle East. In the March 25th edition, he reported on Saddam Hussein's 1988 chemical attack on the Kurds in the northern Iraqi town of Halabja. Goldberg pieced together what happened, based on eyewitness accounts, and wrote about the short and long-term effects of the chemical attack. During the period of the Gulf War, Saddam Hussein was described as having a comparatively secular regime. You say that about 10 years ago he underwent something of a battlefield conversion to a fundamentalist brand of Islam. Do you know what happened?
Well, I can say with reasonable surety that it was not heartfelt. Saddam's an interesting character. He's a pan-Arabist secularist when that's useful. But he also speaks in the language of Islamic fundamentalism when that's useful. I'm not saying that he's a religious person now, God knows. But I think what occurred was he decided that he could link up his cause, his anti-American cause, if you will, with the Islamic fundamentalists who were also developing these anti-American feelings. And that is why it's credible that Saddam and al-Qaeda might be working together. On the face of it, it seems illogical. Saddam is a secularist on paper, and al-Qaeda is obviously, you know, a religiously fundamentalist movement. But they share interests, and so it's not inconceivable.
You say that Saddam Hussein is now a prime supporter of the Palestinian anti-Israeli groups Islamic Jihad and Hamas. Is that common knowledge, or is that something that you found out?
It's certainly common knowledge in the community of people who pay obsessive attention to these sorts of issues. When people look at the supporters of Islamic Jihad and Hamas, they look more to Iran than Iraq. But Saddam Hussein is doing something very interesting. He is, and this has been documented, he is paying the families of suicide bombers a lump sum of $10,000, which of course is an extraordinary amount of money in the West Bank or the Gaza Strip. So he's buying his way into the conflict, if you will, through these large cash grants to suicide bombers. Of course, these kind of cash grants encourage other people to become suicide bombers because they know that their families will be taken care of by Saddam Hussein when and if they blow themselves up in standing in the middle of a crowd of Israeli civilians.
You say that Israel and the Jews are now Saddam Hussein's main preoccupation. Why is that?
Yeah. An interesting scholar named Amatzia Baram, who's from Haifa University, who knows more about Saddam Hussein's family than anybody I've ever met. He reads everything coming out of Iraq. Explained it this way, and this was echoed, by the way, by Iraqi Muslims, dissidents I spoke to. He says this: Saddam wants to be remembered 1,000 years from now. He wants his legacy to be taught to fourth graders in every Arab country 1,000 years from now. He can't do that by killing Kurds. That's not the main game in the Middle East. He can only ensure immortality, if you will, by bringing Israel to its knees. That is the struggle. That is the main field of battle between Arabs and the West, if you will. And so he's a very historically minded figure from everything that I've read and from everyone I've talked to. He frequently compares himself to Hammurabi, to Nebuchadnezzar, to Saladin, and he's looking for a way. Amatzia Baram put it this way. He said he's looking for a way to absolve himself of the sins he's committed against Arabs and against Muslims over the past 20 years. And here's the thing. I think there's some logic to this. If he brought Israel to its knees in some manner, through a biological weapons attack, say, he would be known as the one Arab who actually brought about the destruction or the permanent weakening of Israel. And it's quite a fascinating point. And that's why American military planners, Israeli military planners, Iraqi dissidents, the Kurds themselves will actually say this. They all believe that when push comes to shove, Saddam will save his missiles for an attack on Israel, not on Saudi Arabia or Kuwait or the Kurds.
If there's a connection between al-Qaeda and Saddam Hussein, then al-Qaeda could conceivably get chemical weapons from Iraq. I'm wondering if al-Qaeda would need Iraq for chemical weapons. How difficult are these chemical weapons to make?
Well, I'm convinced that that's the actual short-term danger. There's a famous Iraqi dissident named Kanan Makia I spoke to for this story, and he says this is the scenario. Iraq is the address. Iraq is the state everyone in the world knows builds chemical and biological weapons. If you're a terrorist who needs biological and chemical weapons, that's the address. Right now, of course, with all the focus on Al-Qaeda and all the focus on Iraq, it's very difficult, presumably, to make such an arrangement. But Kanan Makia's argument and the argument of others is that if Saddam is allowed to stay in power over the next couple of years, 3 or 4 years, our interest will wane. If he plays this smart, he'll be very quiet. And then terrorist groups will look to him as the pharmacy, if you will. They'll go to him and go to Iraq for these weapons. And I think it's extraordinarily important when you have an actual state apparatus behind your chemical weapons programs. It's not so easy, I would imagine, for an Al-Qaeda operative sitting in Hamburg, Germany, to create a weapons laboratory. It turns out, you know, as we're seeing, you know, hints of this from Afghanistan, that there was a development program in Afghanistan developed by Al-Qaeda to create these kind of weapons. That sanctuary has now been denied to Al-Qaeda by the American military, but Iraq still exists as an independent state, and an independent state sponsor of these programs is obviously a great threat.
The Bush administration is trying to line up support internationally for attacking Iraq and going after its chemical and nuclear capabilities. Do you feel that your article in The New Yorker adds weight to the Bush administration's argument that some action against Iraq needs to be taken?
Well, I can't deny the obvious. The vice president and the president have both invoked my article as proof of Saddam's nefariousness, if you will. I'm going to let my article speak for itself. As I said, I started working on this 2 years ago. And let me say this. If I had an agenda, it would be to get medical attention for the Kurds who suffered through these attacks. I'm a reporter. I'm not a pundit. I try to go to places and gather information. If the information adds up to a certain conclusion, well, then the information adds up to a certain conclusion. But I'm uncomfortable, obviously, being a pundit on this subject. You know, am I glad that people are talking about my article? Of course. I mean, the worst thing in the world is to have people ignore it. And if people draw certain conclusions about the nature of the regime, well, then they're going to draw those conclusions.
Well, Jeffrey Goldberg, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Jeffrey Goldberg's article, The Great Terror, was published in the March 25th edition of The New Yorker. Coming up, satirist Harry Shearer. He's written and directed a new movie. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Satirist Harry Shearer has written and directed a new movie called Teddy Bear's Picnic. Shearer is a former cast member of Saturday Night Live. He's appeared in many films. He does the voices of several characters on The Simpsons and presents his own political satires every week on his public radio program, Le Show. His new movie is a satire based on the Bohemian Grove in Northern California. It's an exclusive and secretive all-male retreat for the rich and powerful. The membership has included presidents, cabinet members, and business tycoons. Shearer's satire is set at a retreat called Zambezi Glen. In this scene, the Glen is having its inaugural Ladies' Day for the wives and companions of the male membership. The women are welcomed by the patriarch of Zambezi Glen, Porterfield Porty Pendleton, who is also a chancellor of a California university. He's played by Michael McKean.
What you will see today in your short time here, ladies, is a glimpse of a special place. A place where warmth, fellowship, and a love of the arts blossom in the splendid bosom, excuse me, in the splendid lap of nature. Whether we be construction mogul, banker, university president, cabinet member, or humble spinner of the webs of commerce, this is our once-a-year sanctuary. We hope you understand at the end of your brief visit here why, to stay special, this place must remain unknown to others. We share it with you today, so that in 6 weeks, when you lose your menfolk to the Glen for their summertime sojourn here, you will have the smell of our sacred redwoods lingering in your lovely nostrils. And now, in line with our most treasured traditions, as patriarch, I hereby declare the Glen and all its bars open.
Harry Shearer, welcome back to Fresh Air.
Thanks, Terry.
So your new movie is a satire of the Bohemian Grove. Before we get to your satire, what is the thing that you're satirizing?
Well, it's a retreat that has been held every year, every summer, for more than a century in the Redwood Country of Northern California, where the richest and most powerful white men in our country assemble to basically regress to the activities of a college sophomore in a frat house, except on a much higher budget.
Such as?
Well, prodigious amounts of consumption of very potent alcoholic beverages, for one, and the concomitant results therefrom, i.e. lying face down on the golf course for much of the following day, walking around naked and peeing ceremonially on redwood trees from time to time, and putting on elaborate shows that involve a lot of drag. Are three of the main activities. And the thing that got me into this, I'd heard about it for years and known about it a little bit, but that these people at the peak of their power, that's their choice of a week of, you know, a very special week carved out of their busy schedules devoted to that. It just seemed like such a weird, funny choice to me.
So since the Bohemian Grove is so secretive, how did you do any research to figure out what you want to satirize?
Well, you know, most secrets, most people who know secrets love to tell them to somebody. Otherwise, nobody knows that they know a secret. The two independent film producers from San Francisco, both women, who originally approached me and said, we want to do a movie about Bohemian Grove, but we don't really know what kind of movie to do. I said, well, if I do it, it was a comedy. They said, okay. So they knew a lot of people who were former members or relatives of members, sons who had rejected the call to follow the family into the club, hookers who worked for the retreat. It's a very high class of hooker they get. So they made it possible, and they even made it possible for me to see the archives, the club. The Grove is a retreat run by the Bohemian Club. And they have an archive in their clubhouse in San Francisco of all of the posters that they've done of the various shows. They put on these elaborate shows at the end of each encampment with a lot of drag and a lot of pseudo-classical references. And they keep an archive of the posters back 100 years. So I got to look at that. So they really opened the door for me to do a lot of research. And then, totally coincidentally, after I wrote the script, I was invited to visit a little kind of weekend preview at the place itself when I think they were trying to see if they wanted me to consider thinking about joining. And I was going, well, I'd say this is a good opportunity to fact check for me.
Excuse me, they were thinking of asking you, do you represent the rich and the powerful?
No, but one of the other goofy things about, and thank you for asking, one of the other goofy things about this place as opposed to the other gatherings of the rich and powerful, because the original club started out as a club of writers and artists, hence the name, before the businessmen took it over, they retain a certain fondness for having a certain representation of show business people there, kind of as mascots. Partly because they like they need certain amount of professionalism to put on these shows, but also they like having people from show business there, and so I think that was the reason that I was extended the invitation, because they've heard that sometimes I'm in show business.
So you were invited to actually be a member or to show up?
Not to be a member, but to come, you know, it was like, I think, in their eyes, a mutual sniffing out.
And you didn't make the final cut, huh?
I don't think either side wanted to basically, I went, to, as I say, just to fact check, just to see how close I'd gotten in my script. But I don't think that I made whatever cut there might have been, no.
Have you heard from anyone from the Bohemian Grove?
We heard, I think the production office heard kind of informal feelers that maybe it would be nice to have a screening of the movie up at the Grove. This is sort of in the tradition of the saddest thing about doing satire that I've discovered is that you can think you're making really, really hard-nosed fun of people, and 9 times out of 10, their reaction is they're flattered, which is so disappointing. I mean, we did Spinal Tap, and we thought, man, we've really socked it to the heavy metal and hard rock guys, and they've been nothing but flattered ever since. And so I think probably these guys might feel the same way. I don't know. We haven't followed up on those feelers as of yet.
Now, your movie Teddy Bear's Picnic is about to open in a few cities. And so you're in the phase now of movie making that's about, you know, promoting the film, getting to people to know that it exists. Now promotion is something that you have parodied a lot. You've satirized a lot on your show. So what's it like to be on the other end of actually having to do it and to do it in a way that you feel comfortable with?
Present company accepted, it's the worst. No, I mean, I enjoy these kinds of situations where some dusty NPR person is asking me questions.
And sexless.
And sexless. But, you know, this is a world, and I've made fun of this, and now I'm having to deal with it. This is a world in which the entertainment business is owned by about 5 or 6 huge, huge corporations. When they open a movie, when they bring a movie to market, they spend more money just advertising it than I would spend making 20 of these movies.
Mm-hmm.
I'm being literal. So just to make the public aware that a movie exists in this climate is a Sisyphean task. And it's very difficult. Plus, you know, we're coming out like a week and a half after the Oscars. So for a long period of time, a lot of people wouldn't come to our press day, which is when you have a lot of reporters gathered together to sort of interview you, because there was better food at some Oscar preview luncheon, you know, stuff like that. It's very, very difficult. It's I would easily say it's been the most difficult part of the whole process of making an independent movie.
Now, even though you've made fun of people who overplug their thing on a talk show, are you in the position now of being interviewed and having to find creative ways of working in the name of your movie?
Absolutely. Teddy Bear's Picnic opens Friday. Yeah, sure. I mean, part of the curse of being a good observer, I guess, and making fun of the stuff that's really going on is you find yourself doing it willy-nilly. I mean, when we'd made Spinal Tap and then went out on a rock and roll tour and thought, how stupid are we? We're now going through exactly the same kind of crap we made fun of people for doing.
Yeah, but without the cod piece.
Yeah, without, well,
maybe
yes.
Not. Okay.
asks about cod piece again. But yes, it is a humbling experience to be doing some of the same stuff you make fun of people for doing. One hopes one can do it a little more gracefully, or at least with a little more ironic self-awareness than most people who are flogging stuff in public are doing.
Do you go through those like nightmare moments though, where you feel like, oh my God, I'm doing exactly what it is that I make fun of?
The most nightmarish it was ever in that sense was when we were on the road with Tap, and we're running into, you know, promoters who were just as vile and just as stupid, and record companies that were just as rapacious as anything we ever made fun of. And then you just think, how stupid are we? We already know this. We don't have to do the research now. But in that case, the saving grace was we were on stage for 2.5 hours every night playing very loud, and that's always fun.
My guest is satirist Harry Shearer. He wrote and directed the new film Teddy Bear's Picnic. We'll talk more after our break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is satirist Harry Shearer. He wrote and directed the new film Teddy Bear's Picnic. It's a satire based on the exclusive and secretive all-male retreat, the Bohemian Grove. Now, your film, Teddy Bear's Picnic, is opening just after the Oscars.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm sure you were home watching the Oscars from the vantage point of independent filmmaker. So what'd you think of the Oscars?
Schadenfreude. from the Schadenfreude seat. What did I think of the Oscars? Too long. Bring back Steve Martin as the host or let Nathan Lane host it. I didn't really need to have all those people telling me why movies were those little sequences telling me why movies are great. You know, it was a little self-serving. The Oscars? Self-serving? I'm shocked. What else? Oh, yeah. And just on the joke level, you know, when Whoopi walked over and covered up the statue, I was yelling to my significant other, but the statues that John Ashcroft covered up had sexual organs visible. The thing about Oscar is he doesn't. That sort of changes the joke. Oscar has no genitalia, so what she was covering up was a lack of something, not something. But what do you know? It's the Oscars. What are you going to do? It's the Oscars.
Have you ever been to the actual ceremony?
When I was a kid, I went as part of a radio show with my colleagues, Michael McKeon, way back then. And we were not in the auditorium. We were in the radio interview area, and we were being annoying satirical kids who asked the stupidest questions we could think of to people, to celebrities, as they were departing the Oscars, because we knew the radio interview area was the last part of the gauntlet they had to walk before they could get out to freedom. And so our particular form of torture that we applied to them was just to ask really insanely stupid questions to them.
Like what? And, what did you ask?
Have you ever been to New York was one of the classics that we asked. You can't imagine the looks on people's faces when you shove a microphone in front of their face at the Oscars and say, let me ask you a question. Have you ever been to New York? Yeah. Thank you. Because they've just been asked, you know, insanely stupid questions, but nothing as bad as that.
Endearing yourself to the industry at an early age.
That's right.
Something else I want to know what you make of, and that's the Nightline Letterman controversy. I'm wondering what you think of ABC putting Nightline in Jeopardy.
Well, Nightline and Jeopardy together would probably get a better rating. I did a piece on my radio show where I had Ted kind of submit an audition tape for where he thought the program should be going, which is doing a show called Late Night Line with a studio audience and Paul Schaefer and the ABC News Symphony. And his guests were Aaron Brown, who comes on the show and reveals that since he's on opposite Greta Von Susteren, Aaron's now had some eye work done. And Zbigniew Brzezinski, who comes on to discuss, you know, the trouble spots in the world while being dipped into a big vat of oatmeal. And that's basically my opinion of what's going on. You know, for anybody who's shocked that the major networks would rather not be in the news business at this point, pay closer attention is all I can say. I thought that the most bizarre part of the whole thing is the door that it opened into the thing that drives most decisions in commercial broadcasting, which is not ratings and certainly not quality, it's demographics. It's the fact that the advertising business demands the delivery of 18 to 34 or 18 to 49-year-old people, and the belief that anybody outside that age range, well, they, you know, because everybody, when they hear that fact for the first time, says, well, but I'm 54 and I buy a lot of stuff. But the myth in the advertising business is once you've passed 34, your brand preferences are established and you cannot be swayed by advertising.
Oh, is that
therefore,
it?
That's it.
I didn't realize
so
that.
Therefore, and that's the tail that wags the whole dog. And there are people even inside the advertising business who are saying, this is a 30-year-old model now. And the boomers are different, and boomers probably are still making new choices, and we shouldn't be adhering to this model anymore, but their voice is in the wilderness of the advertising jungle.
Do you take this personally, that you're part of a demographic that doesn't count?
Me personally, I never counted. because I had the advantage of working in advertising at a very early age. When I was 18, I worked at an ad agency for a couple of summers. And when you see how the sausage is made, you know, dot, 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 you have bacon.
So did you have to write ads yourself when you were working there?
Yeah, yeah. I wrote ads. I produced ads, produced commercials, did the whole thing. I was part of a big... My favorite part of the advertising experience was when they summoned all of the talent in the agency together for a big push, I think they called it, because a competing soap product or detergent product to the one that was our client had a hugely successful campaign, and our client was desperate to come up with something to match it. And so everybody had to go home and just, you know, push to, you know, and it was just an agency-wide search for some idea that would be as good as Stronger Than Dirt.
Well, Harry Shearer, good luck with the movie. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry. Give my love to Gene Simmons, will you?
Oh, anytime. Harry Shearer wrote, directed, and co-stars in the new satirical film Teddy Bear's Picnic. It opens in New York this weekend and in Los Angeles and San Francisco next week. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer this week is Roberta Sharrock. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Megan Howe, Patty Leswing, Jessica Chu, and Lauren Krenzel. I'm Terry Gross. Here's Harry Shearer with Spinal Tap.
Big teeth. You're too young and I'm too well hung, but tonight I'm gonna rock you. 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 Tonight. Oh, yeah.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Delta Trade Paperbacks, a division of Random House. Publisher of Far Appalachia, Following the New River North by Noah Adams. Available in paperback. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Chris Isaak plays a couple of tunes and talks about his TV series and his new CD. Also, bluffs, tells, and underground poker. We talk with Andy Bellin, a player and writer and author of the new book, Poker Nation. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.